Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
for
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Band.video, Rockfin, Odyssey, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate it. We know you've got a lot of choices. But if you like this show, you can take the additional step of sharing it with your friends and family and spread the word if you like. You can rate the show as well. Hopefully, you'll give me 5 stars if you think I've earned it. I've angered the pronoun people once again. They've taken to the rating the show with a 1 star because they're not, I don't know, because I guess I'm not stunning and brave, whatever. Thanks to our sponsors, they mean that this show actually winds up happening. Legal Shield has been in business for 50 years. They have an A+ rating with the Better Business Bureau, and they are available in Canada and the United States. And basically what it is the collective buying power of all of us directed towards a high power law firm in your area. It gives you access to a lawyer that you probably either couldn't afford or wouldn't want to pay the amount of money it would take to set up a consultation. It's $30 a month. It's $1 a day. It really is very affordable. And considering all the things that you can take care of with a couple stops into your attorney, you can get yourself a last will and testament, which you're going to need, or else the state gets involved in your affairs after you're dead. You can get yourself a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney. These are things you need. You got to have them. You know, we're adults. You can't put this stuff off much longer, but nobody really wants to write that check and spend a couple grand to take care of these documents that are just going to go in your safe and you're probably not going to see them again for a decade. So look, I think that this is an affordable way for you to get in, immediately sign up with your local attorneys, tell them what you want to do. You want to knock these documents out. And then from there, you just kind of keep them on retainer. You've got them if you have questions about your rights, if your work wants you to sign some new contract that has some sort of language in there about medical things having to do with vaccines or whatever, you're going to want to send it over to your attorney, have them take a look. If the IRS is looking to audit you for a W-2, send it over to them. If you've got a speeding ticket or you got something, you know, a red light traffic camera ticket, all that stuff, send it to your attorney. Just absolutely do not even bother with that. Just take it and tell your attorney, look, I got this. I need you to sort this out for me. Or if somebody's giving you a hard time with regard to some service or product that you bought and you don't think that you're being treated fairly, and maybe a letter from your attorney will get things sort of headed down the right path, there's an option there too. I just ask you to please use this as a for good and not evil. Don't go around threatening people that didn't do anything to you. I think that would be bad karma. But if you're interested, you can go to the website that they built specifically for us, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, and take a look and see what you think. They don't, it's just, if you have a small business, but you know, you're big enough to have a couple employees, but not big enough to have a legal department, there's a small business plan for you. You can get the ID Shield component that'll take care of credit monitoring, reputation management, password manager, things like that. Also, if you are a gun owner, you have access to documentation for things like that. There's a lot going on. I suggest go to the website, don'tgetpushedaround.com, read it for yourself, see what you think. Also, our newest sponsor is a great sponsor. It's one of these products that you probably need. You definitely don't want to be a day late on this. This is EMP Shield. EMPShield.com is the website. Go over there and read up on it, man. I'll tell you what. This device will protect you against EMPs. It will protect against solar flares, and it will protect against lightning. I think lightning is probably more realistic. But if you get a solar flare and, you know, the Earth is facing the wrong direction for this and we get blasted, oh man, it's back to the Stone Ages for us. And hopefully that doesn't happen. If the solar flares don't get us, the Chinese EMP spy weather balloon whatevers might get us. Oh God, who knows? But I'll tell you what, this product that they've built over at EMP Shield is many times more efficient than a single-use military design. It can withstand up to 40 EMP blasts. It's fitted to household circuit breakers with just four wires. You can watch the installation videos on EMP Shield's website, or you can go on YouTube and find installation videos. You can do it yourself, or you can have an electrician come in and do it for you. It installs just like a Type 2 surge protector, and it works on your home, car, RV, boat, generator. You can get bundle packages for all of that. So look, all I ask, be proactive, not reactive. There's no sense ordering the EMP shield after the EMP has gone off, all right? That probably wouldn't do you much good. And I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just trying to provide some reasonable solutions ahead of time. So EMPShield.com is the website. Promo code MACRO to save yourself a little bit of money. Well, I'll tell you, I was going down this rabbit hole of like British occupation. You know, I had Rich Willett on. We talked about the Virginia Company, and we started thinking like, God, you know, we might have gotten our physical freedom, our everyday physical freedom from the British a couple hundred years ago. But do you think that they would give up quite that easily on us? I don't know. I don't think so. I think that there has always been a bit of resentment by the British elite that think that the United States should have never been allowed to split off, and that if it were up to them, we would be folded back into the British Empire. Now, this is an ideology that is shared by a lot of the leading psychopaths of the time, like Cecil Rhodes and, you know, the Rothschilds and people like that. So, you know, that they have the financial capacity and the means to make something like that happen. And we also have learned one thing from these people is that they take a long-term look at some of these issues. They're not afraid to play the long game, multi-generationally. You know, they might not be around to see it, but they have some ideas about how to take America back in a covert way, by sowing the seeds of destruction internally and then watching it sort of disintegrate from within. As America stood in the, you know, all through the 20th century, after World War II, I should say, America was on the up. It was on the come up. It was it had all the money. It had all the gold. It had the world's reserve currency. It had a strong military. It was unaffected from bombs, you know, after World War II. Nothing, you know, America didn't have to rebuild anything. So we were able to do things like build the interstate highway system and start to do some infrastructure projects and you know, in Make America Great Again, you know, or Make America Great the First Time or whatever, you know. So we had the upper hand, you know. Europe was rebuilding, Asia was rebuilding after getting, you know, clobbered for you know, a decade of war. They were rebuilding, we were consolidating power and taking off from there. So I think at that time, it was probably a little bit too late to take down America and fold it back into a British empire that was frankly no longer there or disintegrated pretty quickly after World War II. But again, if you're looking at this from a multi-generational standpoint and you've got time and you don't have to take America back right away, there are some things that you can do to hollow us out from the inside, soften us up financially, socially, and later take America back. Now, look, the British Empire, when Cecil Rhodes was formulating these concepts, and back in the late 1800s, the British Empire was the shit. You know, it was tough to beat that. They, you know, as they said, the sun never set on the British Empire, and it was global in nature. It was the first sort of attempt, well, maybe not the first attempt, but the most realistic attempt at world government was this British Empire. And even that, it stalled out after taking over, you know, just several regions. There's only so far you can extend yourself militarily before things start to fall apart at home and and the collapse happens. But they never really gave up on this idea. Cecil Rhodes, his idea was, what we're going to do first is we're going to link up all of the white Anglo-Saxon English-speaking regions together into this British government, you know, into this British Empire. And once we do that, then secondarily on the list will be, you know, destabilize America from within so that it is less strong and that it can eventually be folded back into the empire. So that was the plan. Now, the plan is great in it when it's like the early 1900s, but you know, things got away. America became even stronger. The British Empire became even weaker, and it doesn't seem like a very feasible concept anymore. However, the ideology still remains, and I think that there's a segment of the high-ranking British aristocracy, maybe not limited to British, but you know, the Bilderberg group, let's just call it the royalties, you know, the Prince Bernhard group, they would like to see America come back under royal control. And so they've got these ideas on how to make that happen. And you could do it through a war, a hot war, which doesn't really work very well. Geographically speaking, America's protected on two sides by massive oceans. And of course, in the north, you've got Canada, and maybe that could be a front for the British monarchy to invade America through their, you know, through their Commonwealth of Canada. But I don't think that's very likely. I think the most likely scenario is to just gut us from the inside and do to us what we, the West, did to the Soviet Union. Destabilize their currency, soften them up ideologically, get them to go on these boondoggles where they spend a disproportionate amount of money on things like defending against SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative that Reagan proposed, the Star Wars plan. Remember that? That was never going to happen, but it was talked about like it was going to happen, and Russia thought it was going to happen, and they start spending money they don't have because they're not the world's reserve currency, and they start spending money on things like that, and it starts to bankrupt them. Then they get dragged into a 10-year unwinnable war in Afghanistan, and that helped to bankrupt them. And then guys like Soros come in at the final end and destabilize the currencies and break up the Soviet Union into a bunch of pieces. And I think that game plan is more likely to take down the American empire than an overt war. And I think that our allies, the British, I think they hold a little bit of a grudge. I think they never, and of course, not the British people, of course, but you know, the aristocracy, they have always felt like we were, you know, that we should have never been allowed to leave. So here we go. We get into some of the groups that they have used to to put this plan forth. And we talked about Cecil Rhodes before, about the Rhodes Scholarship, and that is most definitely a plot to inject and install high-ranking, very intelligent double agents into the American system of academia, big business, politics, and the judiciary in order to soften us up internally. But it's not limited to the Rhodes Scholar. In fact, Cecil Rhodes, you know, the round table involved a variety of agencies. One of the agencies is the one that we're going to get into today, which is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, actually initially called the British Institute for International Affairs. And it later received its charter in 1927, its royal charter, to be renamed the Royal Institute for International Affairs. But you'll know it as Chatham House. When you hear the term Chatham House, Chatham House is a building. Chatham House, number 10, St. James Square, right? That's the name of the building where this group operation is based. And it's a London-based independent policy institute, think tank, you know, they're out there thinking, with a stated goal of providing, I feel like I should do it in a British accent, providing commentary on world events and offer solutions to global challenges. Sounds very on the up and up, right? Just a bunch of rich, powerful aristocrats sitting around deciding how to solve global challenges. Probably the global challenges that they themselves created over time. So they're going to create, you know, problem, reaction, solutionist to death on this one. So there's five focuses of Chatham House. We're going to start with the first one. And so you know they're up to no good and dealing in bullshit when the first one right out of the gate is environment and society. You know, it's like, oh, here we go again. We're going to talk about climate change. We're going to talk, you know, it's funny that the wealthy industrialists that are destroying the world, you know, building these massive diamond gold mines and drilling for oil and spilling oil, they're always the ones that are the most concerned about the environment. Yeah, it's right on schedule. So number one, environment and society. Number two, global economy and finance. They're worried about money. Number three, global health security. They're worried about trying to kill you under the guise of protecting you and saving you with global health security. Number four, international law. Because if there's one thing we know about these globalist scumbags, they follow the law. And number five, international security, which is code for, I don't know, how can we invade your country and take it over, right? So there are the five focuses: environment and security and society, global economy and finance, global health security, international law, international security. So they're dealing with environment, money, health, law, and war. So, and they focus on six regions. Number one is Africa. Oh boy. Sorry, Africa. You're about to get some democracy spread on your, you're about to get some Commonwealth spread all over your region. Number two, Asia Pacific. Number three, Europe. Number four, Middle East and North Africa. Number five, Russia and Eurasia. And number six, the United States and the Americas. So it's international in scope. There's about 6,000 members of it. It's not small. I'm not going to pretend like all 6,000 members are in on the plan. It's probably a lot like the Freemasons or some other large organization where you've got a very small percentage at the very top that know what's going on, and another, you know, and the bulk of people maybe down at the bottom that are networking. They think they're going to meet some, you know, going to make some good business connections, and maybe they're up on the plan to an extent, but I don't know that they're. I'm not going to say that everybody that's involved in this is some ruthless globalist scumbag, and they're adjacent to that for sure, but not necessarily in on it to the full degree. And also now this group is focused on what they call the sustainability accelerator. Okay, climate change. They recognize the scam. They know the scam. They're involved in the scam. They this group, by the way, this roundtable group includes the Club of Rome, who invented the concept of climate change. So let's not pretend like when you hear sustainability accelerator and that their focus is on the environment, that they're out there trying to fix anything. No, 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 no. They're part of the scam. It came from their organization, from the head of, if you want to talk about the head of the octopus being Cecil Rhodes Roundtable, right? And then the tentacles being a variety of things, including Chatham House and Club of Rome and the Council on Foreign Relations. And we'll get to that in a little bit. So you might have heard a term called the Chatham House Rule. Have you heard that before? There's only one rule. Quote, when a meeting or part there, this one I definitely should read in a British accent, but I won't. When a meeting or part thereof is held under the Chatham House rule, participants are free to use the information received, but neither the identity nor the affiliation of the speaker, nor that of any other participant may be revealed. So, it's a big secret. You can use the information that comes out of it. Whatever we've talked about, whatever they've, you know, after this big, big meeting, all that stuff, you can use it, but you can't mention who's talking about it. You can't mention who's in that meeting with you. You just can't mention names or organizational names, you know. So you can start talking about how the climate is changing and how, you know, we have to make this push towards sustainable living and all that, but you can't mention that the guy from the Club of Rome is in there telling you that, which, let's be honest, makes a huge difference, right? It's not some altruistic guy in there talking about like, oh, if only we could save the planet. It's like Maurice Strong is in there saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to enslave humanity with this fake climate change thing. So go out and tell everybody that that there's too much carbon in the atmosphere and that we're going to need to modify behavior in order to save the earth. And then, but don't tell them the part about how we tax the carbon and we put them in 15-minute cities and we monitor how much meat they're eating. And we don't tell them all that stuff. But tell them this. Oh, and by the way, if you spill the beans, you're out. It's just as simple as that. There's one rule, and the rule is don't mention any names. And if you mention any names, you're out. So this rule is in place because the topics covered by the secret group would harm their reputation. They know that. That's why this is a huge secret. So they don't want you to know what they're discussing and plotting because, you know, because to know that would give up the plan. And they've got to have coordination. So you've got to have this big group to get together and talk about all this stuff. So they keep it simple, you know, and this rule has been in place since 1927, you know, right when it became the Royal Institute after it became, you know, after it dropped the British Institute moniker, it changed over and the rule has been in place. So the rule has been in place for about 100 years. Okay. And so, you know, you go, well, okay, how do we know that these are bad people though? I mean, maybe it's good people. Maybe these people aren't as nefarious as you assume they are. Well, maybe, but why don't we do this? Why don't we take a look at who they're giving the Chatham House Award to? And then you decide whether or not you think this is an organization that's up to, you know, benefiting humanity or out to destroy humanity. So it's the award for, quote, significant contribution to the improvement of international relations. So who is making these significant contributions to improve international relations? Well, some of the previous winners are Lula, socialist dictator of Brazil, who definitely didn't steal that election. Hillary Clinton, because if there's one thing we know, she improves international relations when she's not dropping bombs on Libya and you know, we came, we saw, he died, you know, that sort of thing. None other than Bill Gates has won the award because he's a altruistic gentleman and scholar. And yeah, he's not a doctor, you know, but still. And yes, he's been thrown out of a bunch of countries for killing babies with his vaccines and giving 496,000 Indian children polio from his oral polio vaccines. But, you know, mistakes were made and we can't really hold that against. John Kerry won the award when John Kerry's not flying around the planet in his G5 lecturing the general public about their carbon output. He's getting awards from Chatham House. And Sir David Attenborough, World Economic Forum, Sir David Attenborough, is receiving awards from there as well. And not to be outdone, though she's not a full-fledged member, Greta Thunberg is a, quote, young advisor. Does that answer your question about the Chatham House Award and what they're up to? Yeah, it's not good. So let's go back. The first meeting of the British Institute for International Affairs happened right after the end of World War I, like quite literally right after it, May 30th, 1919. They got together and it was decided that those meetings after World War I should continue. They should continue and with the British and the Americans and go back home and sort of do your own version of this. So it then branched off, you know, back home to the British Institute of International Affairs, and then to America. The branch was called the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay, so when you hear CFR, CFR connected, CFR president, CFR board of director, and we'll get to some of these people in a minute. Just understand that you're talking about a subset of Chatham House. And again, much like Cecil Rhodes envisioned, the Council on Foreign Relations is there to destabilize America. Not help it, okay? And when you see some of the people, and like I said, I've got a list of some of these people. When you see them, you're gonna know these are boogeymen, American boogeymen, and so the CFR is masquerading as a foundation that is helping the United States deal with foreign adversaries and to improve international relations, you know, like Hillary Clinton won the award for. But what did Hillary Clinton call the CFR? She called it the mothership. You remember that? But it shouldn't be too much of a surprise because Hillary's husband, Bill Clinton, is a Rhodes Scholar. So he understands the game. It is the mothership. And remember she said, you don't have to go too far because they built the new one in Washington, D.C. So now I don't have to go too far to go to the mothership to be told what to do. Remember when she said that? Yeah. So we've got the... So that's what happened. So after World War I, they said, after the Paris Peace Accord, they said, this was very successful. We think this was really well done. Let's continue this, even though we just had this first one for the war. I like what we're doing here. We should continue this, but we should branch it off. So let's do sister operations. Chatham House on one end, CFR on the other. So the British Institute for International Affairs was conceptualized by a guy named Lionel Curtis, who pushed the idea of British Empire federalism as a replacement to colonial imperialism. This was a guy that was installed and deeply mentored by Cecil Rhodes. So, you know, he comes at it from this bloodthirsty agenda of connecting the English speaking regions of the world together into one larger British empire and then destabilizing America as sort of a secondary thing. So he was this Lionel Curtis guy was pushing the roundtable movement all the way back in 1909, which Carol Quigley said was actually a secret society called the Society of the Elect, that he said was set up by Cecil Rhodes to unite all English-speaking nations and ultimately unite the United States under the British Empire. So this is a concept and an idea that's been around for a while. Carol Quigley talked about it. It's only secret to the extent that people don't go digging around looking for it. But if you do, you will find that the roundtable movement was very much, had an ideology. And it was British rule of everything, starting with the English speakers, get America back into the fold. And then once we've got that, then we'll focus on the rest of the world and we'll just make everything under British rule, a one world government. So they're very upfront about this one world government. And of course, Cecil Rhodes was partnered with the Rothschilds. So the De Beers diamond mines are and the gold mines, those are partnerships between the two of them. Cecil Rhodes left his fortune to the Rothschilds. He had no kids because he was a closeted homosexual who was in charge of and very much interested in dominating people however you can dominate them, whether that be financially or spiritually or take their land from them or rape them, okay? These guys were diabolical. And the way they saw it was it's all about power. So he left no heirs. He left his money back to, you know, to these organizations and for them to carry on his work. And his work was that of really enslaving the world. So so BIIA Chatham House was formed by Lionel Curtis really to continue the work of Cecil Rhodes of uniting the world under British Empire rule, at a concept known as federal world government. So there's always world government. There's different flavors of it. And this version, this federal world government was like, well, we don't want to call it British world government. That would just be too obvious. So we're going to call it federal world government. But that's really what it was. It's a world government controlled by the, you know, the elites of the time back then. Right now, it seems a little preposterous because the British Empire isn't what it used to be. So it's easy for people to be dismissive of this and say, oh, well, you know, it, who cares now? Because they can destabilize America if they want. They're not going to fold it back into the British Empire because the British Empire doesn't exist. Well, maybe it does and maybe it doesn't. You know, maybe it exists in a different form. Maybe it's less overt physical occupation and more covert financial control through offshore banking colonies and the like. So I think that there's a case to be made that that the British Empire never really went away. It, not to the extent that we would like to believe it, but it went underground, which happens quite a bit in these movements over time. You find that, you know, they're dominate Knights Templar, things like that, and then they go underground. And you go, okay, well, where'd they go? And then they pop up under in some other place under a different name, and you're looking for the British Empire registered trademark, and they pop up as the CFR, and you're not looking for that, you know, or they pop up as Chatham House, and you go, well, maybe that's British, but CFR I wouldn't think is British. Or maybe it pops up as the United Nations, you know, which is most definitely a version of this. So, in fact, when they said the federal world government, even though it never actually materialized, the next closest thing is known to be what we call today the United Nations. So this is a version of it. The Rhodes Scholars, you know, we've talked about that, how they push for policies designed to destroy America. You've got the Bill Clintons and Rachel Maddows of the world out there doing it. They're Chrystia Freeland in Canada, so it's not limited to America. But these people that are double agents set to destabilize the governments, however, you know, by whatever means necessary. So this is the okay. So we're going to talk about a world state, right? A world. When I say state, I don't mean like California. I mean like country, a world country. And they describe this. They're very open about what you would need in order to make something like this work. They say you need four items. You need, number one, a monopoly on organized violence. An exclusive use of legitimate force, okay? So you have to have the monopoly on violence. You have to be the state. The government has the monopoly on violence currently. Number two, legitimacy. You need to be perceived as right by the population, okay? You have to have the authority on violence, meaning the police force or your armies or whatnot, the legal system. Then you also have to be perceived as not being an occupier. You have to be perceived as legitimate. And fuck, I mean, I don't perceive any governments as being legitimate. But again, take me out of the equation. This is the recipe or the blueprint, the step-by-step guide that you need to follow if you want to create one of these world governments. And then number three, sovereignty, possessing common power and legitimacy. Back to legitimacy. You have to, it can't be some state that's sort of looked at as being, you know, untrue. People have to believe in it. You have to show this is a believable government. It can't just be some fringe thing. It has to have, it has to be at least the perception of legitimacy. I mean, because no government is actually legitimate, but the perception of legitimacy really is, frankly, all you need at this point. And number four, you need corporate action. This means a collection of individuals who act together in a systematic way. Corporate action. That could be perceived as government action. I also tend to think of it as these think tanks. These think tanks are a collection of individuals who act together in a systematic way. So if you've got those things, then this world government then comes into formation through what they've described as a five-step process. Okay. Step number one, system of states. Again, I don't mean 50 states of America. I mean, nation states, right? System of states. These are countries. Okay. Number two, society of states. This is the grouping up of countries into much bigger unions. The European Union would be one. The North American Union that they've talked about would be one as well. AFRICOM, you know, groups like that where you can kind of click up smaller regionalized countries into one bigger super state type thing. Number three, world society. This would be the United Nations, okay? And number four, collective security. This would be NATO. This is North American Treaty Organization. This is a group of countries that have collectively come together militarily to defend an idea or a concept or a region or whatever. And number five, the world state. This is the New World Order. And this is what they talk openly about. They want the New World Order. So you start with a system of states, countries. You group that together into a society of states, like the EU. You then group that society of states together into a world society, the United Nations. You then provide collective security for this world society through a group like NATO, World Army. I ask the question, if you have a world army, who are they going to fight? Who's the enemy? If everyone's a part of this, if we're all in this one world government and we have a world army, who are we fighting? We're either fighting aliens or we're fighting the people. They're directing it towards the people. Maybe we'll fight both. I don't know. Maybe the aliens can be on our side to help fight the collective security of NATO in this world society. I don't know. I'm open to ideas. And then lastly, once you've got the world society, United Nations-like, and you've got the collective security of NATO-like, then you've got the then you blend that together and you've got what they describe as the world state, the new world order. So that's the process. That's the step-by-step process. They say there's five steps. I believe them. Okay. So let's move on. So we asked the question, what are these guys up to? Like, really? Is this just a circle jerk where a bunch of rich aristocrats and business owners and politicians come down and have these fantasies about world government? Are they actually doing it? Are they depopulating? We all know that the common thread running through all this stuff is depopulation. They love it. They talk openly about it. Back in the day, they called it the British Eugenics Society. They put organizations together like Planned Parenthood, which is a depopulation front. They have the World Wildlife Fund, which was started by Prince Bernhard and Prince Philip. You know, all these groups that are like there to protect the wild and protect the people and you know, make sure that we have better stock of these human population. And they don't want to mention that Margaret Sanger said that she started Planned Parenthood to take care of our, quote, Negro problem. I mean, that doesn't look very good on the billboard, you know, so you keep that sort of suppressed. But at its core, these are depopulation outfits. They've always have been, because what they didn't mention in this five-step process is that instead of, you know, maybe one is system of states, maybe before you get to one, it's depopulation. It just is, because it's easier to control all these people if there are fewer of them around. So in 1958, Chatham House created a group called the Institute of Race Relations. I know. It's not going to be good. You're right. And this was undoubtedly a eugenics front organization. And I think you could probably even describe it as, oh, I'd call it scientific racism sponsored by big business, right? As long as it's sciency, you can get away with it. It's so Chatham House comes out. They start the Institute for Race Relations, and then they go out and get funding for it. Now, if it was funded by, you know, people or underprivileged people, well, not that they'd be funding this, but you know, if it was just funded by the people, I would maybe have a different take on it. But when they went out and got funding for it, they got funding from the Ford Foundation, which was deeply involved in eugenics, Barclays Bank, Unilever, and Rio Tinto, which is one of the, like, maybe the largest mining companies in the world. Okay. Again, what do you use in mines? Slave labor, child slave labor, if you're doing it right in Central Africa, right? That all of these things. So excuse me if I'm just a tiny bit suspicious when the Institute of Race Relations, put together by the Chatham House, which is financed and brought into existence by a deeply racist depopulationist like Cecil Rhodes, comes out and all of a sudden wants to help the black people in Africa, right? So they put this group together, and it wasn't just these organizations. There are many multinational corporations in order to fund, quote, research in Africa, and Britain, all the former colonies of Britain. So that included India as well, and, you know, places like that. So, look, it just seemed to me like they were bringing in the big businesses to finance this, because what they were trying to do was figure out how they could get these big businesses access to Africa, India, places like that, where they can continue making a ton of money while exploiting their population under the cover of making it look like they're not exploiting the population, which is what you've got to do. So overall, the mission of Chatham House and CFR is to promote eugenics and world government. You know, that's basically what it is. And you will find former CFR presidents that were Rhodes scholars. And that would be expected. It's a similar overlapping ideology. Like Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's also one of the PNAC guys too. So let's talk about this real quick, about who's on the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, the American Chatham House, run by people that are actively trying to destroy America and promote eugenics and create a world government. Okay, so who's on the board? Well, let's start with the chairman of the board, David Rubenstein. Do you know who David Rubenstein is? One of the most dangerous people in the world. He's the founder of the Carlyle Group. Okay, again, if the Carlyle Group rings a bell, George H.W. Bush was in Washington, D.C. on the morning of September 11th, having a meeting with the Bin Laden family on behalf of the Carlyle Group, when Mohammed Atta and his band of merry pranksters allegedly committed these horrible acts on America. So again, the president of the United States' dad was having a meeting with Osama bin Laden's dad on the morning of September 11th in Washington, D.C. But I'm sure that's just a tremendous coincidence, right? So on behalf of Carlyle Group, which David Rubenstein runs, the president of CFR, okay, who was also a member of the Project for a New American Century, who planned 9/11, with the Israelis and the Saudis. Okay. Also on the CFR board, we've got Jamie Miskik. She's former CIA, head of global security for Lehman Brothers. You get an F on that one, and worked for Kissinger and Associates. Okay. So that's not good. And then we have, I mentioned Richard Haass. He's a PNAC Zionist. He's the director of foreign policy at Brookings Institute. Brookings Institute is the largest think tank in the world. Number one, Chatham House is second only to Brookings Institute. Third on that list would be CFR. So we've got Richard Haass, man. He's knee deep in it. But who's on the CFR board? Ash Carter, former defense secretary, Rhodes Scholar, Larry Fink, head of BlackRock, Janet Napolitano, former head of DHS. She's the if you see something, say something lady. Jay Johnson, former head of DHS. Tim Geithner, New York Fed, Obama's finance guy. William McRaven. You know who William McRaven is? William McRaven was the head of JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command. JSOC was Dick Cheney's private murder squad. Yeah, he's on the CFR board. Nothing to see here, right? What about just traditional old run-of-the-mill members of CFR? Well, we've got Madeleine Albright, the lady who said that 500,000 dead Iraqi children was, quote, worth it. We have Lloyd Austin, general pronouns, with his triple mask and face shield, board director of Raytheon, who rotated out of there to become the secretary of defense for the Biden administration. He's doing a shitty job of that. We have Elliot Abrams, PNAC Zionist. We have Leon Black, head of Apollo Capital Management, Epstein's buddy, had to resign from Apollo because of his massive connections with Epstein. And when those emails got leaked, it was not good for him. We have Epstein himself was a CFR member. I'm sure that's no surprise. We have Anthony Blinken, who's a trilateral. We have L. Paul Bremer. Do you remember L. Paul Bremer? He was the first American on the morning of September 11th to just coincidentally, instead of being in his office in Marsh and McLennan in the top floor of the World Trade Center, he, instead of being there and dying with everybody else in his office, he was down at NBC News waiting to go on to talk about this terrorist attack that hadn't happened yet, but he was going to talk about it anyway. And he was the one that floated the idea that it was Osama bin Laden. He is a member of the Project for a New American Century as well, which means he planned 9/11. And he also became in charge of overseeing Iraq once the Iraq war started to happen. He had no formal experience in that, but then again, would you expect anything less? Okay, George Clooney's on the list of CFR, which shouldn't be a real surprise because he's United Nations tied and deep state to his core. Bill Clinton is on this list. I know. You're very surprised. Since his wife called it the mothership and she's been a member forever, Bill Clinton's a member. Chelsea Clinton's a member, right? Hank Greenberg's a member. He's the insurance guy. Did the insurance payoffs on 9/11. Definitely not a member of the Project for a New American Century and a deep Zionist or anything. Except that he is. Yeah. So look, this is the Council on Foreign Relations. This is the sister organization to Chatham House. Just as devious, just as up to no good. But it is it's hidden from us just because most people don't really know to look there. They don't know what they're looking for. They don't know who to look for. Well, I'll tell you, these names, when you see these names, you will know that there's a lot of people in that organization that are up to no good. So let's talk about this. So here's a quote from roundtabler Sir Philip Kerr to roundtabler Chatham House head Lionel Curtis. It's a letter to the guy Lionel Curtis who started Chatham House, and he's talking about the American problem. He said, quote, "They take an attitude towards the problem of world government exactly analogous to the one they earlier took towards the problem of the world war," talking about World War I. "If they are slow in learning, we shall be condemned to a period of strained relations between the various parts of the English-speaking world, We must get into the heads of the Canadians and Americans that a share in the burden of world government is just as great and glorious a responsibility as participation in the war. So don't come at me with, oh, these guys aren't planning a world government. They talk openly about it. Now, if you and your dipshit friends get hammered on a Saturday night and start talking about world government, it only goes so far, right? You guys, you maybe order pizza and that's the extent of it. When these guys talk about world government, it takes on a whole new tone because they understand how to make it happen. They've got a five-step process for it. And they have the financial and capacity to do that. And the connections too. So it's really worth paying attention when you hear these guys talking about world government to not just dismiss that as conspiracy theory. You know, it's tempting to do that, but when you hear their words, it's part of the reason why my octopus book was as appreciated by the general public as it was, because I found those quotes. I found those 700 quotes from 500 different people. And when you read it, you go, holy shit. You know, I can't believe they said this. And it's like, well, I mean, they wrote it in a letter that they didn't think you were going to read. They didn't think, you know, when Henry Kissinger's National Security Council Memorandum 200 comes out, when he says that our foreign policy towards the third world should be that of depopulation, he didn't think you were going to read it. That's why he was so open. So sometimes you catch these nuggets, you know. So look, I think it's probably worth mentioning that after World War II, a large group of Chatham House members went to work for the United Nations and the World Bank. I mean, it's probably not a surprise to you, but for the record, they did. They installed themselves in the United Nations and the World Bank because, you know, again, when you're plotting a world government, you move up you go up to number three on the five-step list. You go to the World Society, United Nations. Right, United Nations, World Bank, same thing. They're all in this together. They're all Rockefeller, you know, connected. So, and not just the World Bank. I should add to this the International Monetary Fund, which IMF, World Bank. You know, I put them in the same sort of category. Globalist think tanks filled with Chatham House members, CFR members as well. And again, you're not required to pick one or the other. You can be a member of multiple groups, as evidenced by some of these people that I read off, like Richard Haass and guys like that. They're members of all kinds of groups: Aspen Institute, Chatham House, you know, CFR, whatever. You know, they'll be members of United Nations. So, all right. So I want to read this. So. Let's kind of fast forward to today. Let's wrap up with what they're doing these days, because they'll tell you what they're doing by the reports that they're writing and what they're focusing on. So now that you have the backstory as to who these people are and what they want and how they plan to go about doing it, now I want you to hear the titles of these reports. I'm not even going to get into the details of what is written in these reports. It's we could, but you just get bogged down in it. But just the titles of it alone kind of give you an idea of the ambitions of the organization. So so knowing what we know about their focus on world government, projecting white power, destroying America, forming a world government, quiet subversion. Take a look at these topics recently covered by Chatham House. So here's number one. I'm just going to give you the name of the report, and then you just go from there. Changing climate, changing diets, pathways to lower meat consumption. Uh-oh, looks like we figured out who's running the Don't Eat Meat campaign. It's Chatham House, CFR. Changing climate, changing diet. The climate's changing? I didn't know. Did you guys at the Club of Rome? Oh, you're the ones that are talking about climate change. I gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Another component, another spoke on the round table wheel, right? Changing climate, changing diets, pathways to lower meat consumption. No wonder Bill Gates got an award. Here's another one. Towards a new global business model for antibiotics, delinking revenues from sales. So they're working on antibiotics now. They're working on there's what this article goes on to say is delinking revenues from sales. They're saying, don't worry about the money so much when it comes to these antibiotics. We've got bigger plans for them, right? So get ready for that. Here's one that'll be interesting. It's just the name of the article. 2017, the struggle for Ukraine. Oopsie. The next one on the list, choke points and vulnerabilities in global food trade. You know, there weren't choke points and vulnerabilities in the global food trade until you assholes started monkeying with it and started doing things like COVID and causing supply chain issues and telling the ports that they couldn't accept trucks that didn't run, that weren't clean energy trucks, even though clean energy trucks don't exist, and making sure that the rail lines in America were totally fucked up, and then putting Pete Buttigieg in charge of the rail lines and the ports and all the transportation, even though he's a Rhodes Scholar sent to destroy America. Next on the list, oh boy, Nigeria's booming borders, the drivers and consequences of unrecorded trade. Uh-oh, Nigeria, sounds like you're about to get some democracy dropped on your, Commonwealth, you're about to get some Commonwealth dropped on your ass, on your backside. Here's another one, collective action on corruption in Nigeria, a social norms approach to connecting society and institutions. 2017, they have a boner for Nigeria. Let me read you a quote about Nigeria. It says, they say, the problem of Nigeria is based on complex leadership. Lead Nigeria for an inclusive and sustaining Nigeria that works for all. That's Chatham House 2023, just recently, Peter Obi, presidential candidate. Oh, a Nigeria that's inclusive, you say? Really? Really? You're going to have to import some honkies like me to Nigeria if you want to be inclusive, I'm telling you right now. Here's another one of their articles that definitely isn't predictive programming or anything. Quote, heat, light, and power for refugees, saving lives, reducing costs. Right before the migrant crisis in Europe? What a coincidence. It's almost like you guys made it happen. But that would be crazy. Next one, quote, elite perceptions of the United States in Latin America and the post-Soviet states. So this is an article to see how hated America is in Latin America and Central America. It's like, yeah, we destabilize your governments, throw them in, you know, rig elections, install our puppets so that they'll sell us your natural resources at a reasonable price. Of course you guys hate America. I don't blame you one bit for that. Oh God, here's a dangerous one. This is from 2018. Artificial intelligence and international affairs. Yeah. That's dangerous because when they're involved in artificial intelligence and international affairs, you know something bad is going to happen. And the last one of these articles I kind of bookmarked is conflict economies in the Middle East and North Africa, with an emphasis on Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. That's weird. Aren't all four of those countries that America just bombed back to the Stone Age? That's really weird that these conflict economies, you're now worried about studying. They all have one thing in common. America bombed them. I mean, Iraq overtly, Syria, we weren't supposed to be. Libya and Yemen, we're definitely pretending like we didn't bomb them, but we did. And if we weren't bombing them, we were financing Saudi Arabia to bomb them. So, ay, ay, ay. Moving on, Chatham House was ranked think tank of the year, Playboy Playmate of the Year, Chatham House in 2017 by the University of Pennsylvania, the second most influential think tank in the world behind the Brookings Institute and the most influential non-US think tank in the world. So before you just dismiss Chatham House as this you know, group of guys sitting around wearing powdered wigs and talking about the good old days when you could enslave black people. This is actually a really dangerous group. And as this points out, it is the most influential think tank outside of the United States. So you can sleep on Chatham House at your own peril, but these guys are plotting and planning for a future that includes very few human beings and a world government that they run. And we'll wrap up with this. Have you heard the term the special relationship? It's a special relationship between the British and Americans, you know, because we sort of have a lot in common, right? This special relationship between Britain and America is a gigantic lie, okay? The true intention of the British monarchy is to take control of America once again, put it back into the British Empire, which now exists mostly as offshore banking colonies and the city of London, and covertly run, through the use of these secret societies, America's foreign policy. We're being hijacked by the British again. But the thing about the British is that when they hijack you, they're always very, very polite about it. And we respect the hell out of them for doing that. So thank you to the UK for enslaving us with your pinky held high like a good Brit should. Hey, if you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression, or you can go to the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thank you, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.